Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 5, Episode 9, The Fall of the Tang Dynasty. As you may have guessed from my allusions last season, the Tang Dynasty had some intense struggles during the 750s and beyond. The An Lushan Rebellion was far and away the worst disaster of its time for the Tang. The empire they had created and maintained would never fully recover from both this destructive war and the cascade of rebellions and wars that followed. The story goes that in the 740s, Tang Emperor Xuanzong gradually lost interest in managing affairs of state and turned his attention instead to his concubines, who were said to have numbered in the tens of thousands. Leaving the exaggeration aside, the emperor began favoring one above all the others, one Lady Yang Guifei. As their relationship progressed, he impressed her by awarding high offices to members of the Yang family, gradually appointing her cousin Yang Guozhong to a variety of offices before making him chancellor. Yes, you heard that correctly. The emperor appointed him as chancellor. Historical accounts accuse Yang Guozhong of being a layabout gambler and a petty tyrant who constantly alienated his subordinates and even expelled those who disagreed with his opinions on governance. His tendency to create enemies did not stop with lower-ranking bureaucrats. He soon came into conflict with a military governor named An Lushan. The infighting between the men escalated, as these things often do, with Chancellor Yang trying to defame the governor to the sovereign, and An Lushan bribing inspectors and biding his time, building up his troop numbers in the name of securing the northern border. While Governor An worked for the Tang Dynasty, he was not ethnically Han Chinese, but had murkier origins among the Persian Sogdian people and the Goturk. In 755, he requested permission to replace 32 Han Chinese generals with leaders of foreign origin, and Yang Guozhong probably thought he finally had the convincing evidence he needed. An Lushan was certainly preparing to rebel. Emperor Xuanzong, however, was not convinced that this was a sign of rebellion, and granted permission over the chancellor's objections. Finally, in late 755, the emperor once again summoned An Lushan to the capital to answer charges of plotting rebellion, charges which the governor had successfully defended himself against the previous year. On this occasion, however, An Lushan refused the summons and instead mobilized the considerably large army which the emperor had allowed him to accumulate. Before the capital could stop him, Governor An and his army crossed the Wei River in the east and sacked Luoyang around the beginning of 756, putting himself within striking distance to the capital. He claimed that he had received secret orders from the emperor to bring his army to Chang'an and have the chancellor removed by force. His eldest son and two of his wives were in the capital at the time, and the emperor ordered them executed, which only gave An Lushan even greater reason to overthrow the Tang dynasty entirely. Chancellor Yang immediately deployed troops to the Tong Pass, which An Lushan and his forces would have to cross in order to reach Chang'an. However, he did not trust that army's leader, General Geshu Han, whom he suspected was plotting against him. The truth was that the general had already refused a suggestion by a well-meaning aide that he kill the chancellor and take his place. Geshu's plan was to take up defensive positions in the Tong Pass, where his troops could not be easily dislodged without great cost to An Lushan's troops. Word had already been sent to two other generals in the north who were following An Lushan's path and, if things had gone to plan, the three armies would have sandwiched the rebels and crushed them. Not a bad plan. Unfortunately, it would never happen. The chancellor's suspicion of General Geshu was so strong that he sent a lackey, one Du Chonghur with an army of his own to the Tong Pass to keep an eye on the general while they waited for An Lushan to make a move. General Geshu did not enjoy the idea that the chancellor was spying on him, and at his soonest opportunity he had Du Chonghur executed on some pretense. This did nothing to dissuade Chancellor Yang, who went to the emperor and told him he was confident that this whole silly matter could be resolved without the intervention of the northern armies. The emperor trusted his chancellor's judgment and sent orders for General Geshu to assault the vanguard of An Lushan's forces. The general protested but obeyed, and the imperial army guarding Tong Pass was utterly crushed in the ensuing battle. General Geshu himself was captured. There was now nothing between An Lushan and the capital except an empty road. The court flew into a panic. Chancellor Yang advised that they immediately evacuate the court and the army to Chengdu, which would put a large, rugged mountain range between themselves and the rebels. The catch, of course, was that they would need to cross that range first. What happened next is a famous moment in Chinese history. When the army reached a place called Ma Wei, the emperor's guards finally decided that they'd had enough. They were hungry, exhausted, and angry at having to abandon the capital, and they knew exactly who was to blame. Included in the refugees were ambassadors from the Tibetan Empire, who met with the chancellor to complain that they also had not been fed, and so the leaders of the imperial guards took this opportunity to proclaim that Chancellor Yang was plotting treason with the envoys from Tibet. They rushed into the meeting, weapons out, and killed the chancellor. Then they murdered one of Yang's sons, as well as several of the concubines whom they judged to be loyal to the Yang family. The chancellor's wife and remaining children fled the carnage but were hunted down and killed. Then the guards surrounded the emperor's pavilion and demanded that Lady Yang be put to death. Emperor Xuanzong emerged from his lavish tent and pleaded with the guards to stand down. They remained unmoved by their sovereign's appeal. He ordered them to disperse. They remained, surrounding the tent but not advancing upon him. Yet. The emperor's remaining advisors urged him to order the execution of Lady Yang, no doubt fearing for their own lives as well as his. Eventually, Emperor Xuanzong saw that he had no choice. He ordered that Lady Yang should be taken to a nearby Buddhist shrine and strangled there. Her body was presented to the guards afterward and, satisfied, they returned to their posts. Emperor Xuanzong retired soon after this incident, and his son took the throne as Emperor Suzong. The ensuing war lasted for over 7 years, and An Lushan declared independence for the northern region where he had been serving as military governor, naming the new nation Yan. In an ironic twist, when his second son An Qingshu fell out of his father's good favor in 757, he arranged for the old man, who had fallen victim to blindness and ulcers, to be assassinated. This plot succeeded, and An Qingshu became the second emperor of the Yan state. 2 years later, Emperor An Qingshu found himself horribly besieged after a losing campaign and offered the crown to Shi Siming, an old friend of his father who was a fellow general. Emperor Shi ordered An Qingshu's execution shortly thereafter for patricide. 2 years after that, in 761, Emperor Shi Siming's son, Shi Chaoyir, staged a coup against his father and took the throne. He would be the final emperor of the Yan state, which would be crushed at last in 763. Thus, with their only problem solved, the Tang Dynasty led all of China into a glorious and prosperous age. Sorry, just kidding. The An Lushan Rebellion is instructive not because it was successful in the long term, but because it reveals the intense structural weaknesses of Tang Dynasty rule in the mid-700s and beyond. While it would still be nearly another century and a half until they finally collapse, the An Lushan Rebellion is seen as a gigantic red flag that something had gone severely amiss. The truth was that regional military governors, or jiaduxi, had begun to accumulate power in the early 700s, and something like the An Lushan Rebellion was bound to happen sooner or later. The late 700s were filled with similar rebellions from similar leaders from all around their periphery. To try and stave off further problems with the jiaduxi, the Tang government agreed to allow them to pass their titles and commands to their sons without the formality of an exam or really any outside qualification at all. I mentioned in the first episode of this season that the Tang dynasty abandoned the equal field allotment system in 780. What arose in its place was, you may have guessed it, large privately owned estates which continued to expand throughout the 800s. This transition wasn't entirely bad for the central government, however, as they could now act solely as a tax collector and could leave the relevant offices of census and land allotment vacant. Unlike the growing Shouans in Japan, the estates in China were not tax-exempt. Before we get to the Tang dynasty's final collapse, I think it's worthwhile to examine their legacy in East Asian history and indeed against the wider tapestry of world history. Under Tang leadership, China had restored its reputation as a sort of Rome of the Far East, influencing the cultures of their neighbors who often continued the practice of certain customs, both governmental and cultural, long after China itself had abandoned them. Southern China in particular flourished under Tang rule, becoming a trading hub whose appendages reached as far west as the Persian Gulf. Some refer to the routes from the Gulf to the southern ports of China as the Maritime Silk Road. In regards to religion, Tang China acted as a sort of hub for divinities from the world over. The first Muslims arrived in western China while Muhammad was still alive, and Zoroastrianism was practiced in various corners, along with Buddhism, of course, as well as Taoism, and even Christianity. The Christians who came to Tang China were part of the Church of the East, and are often referred to as Nestorians. By 635, when Christian missionaries first presented themselves before Emperor Taizong, Nestorian Christianity had long been declared heretical by the Church in Rome, but they found a welcoming home in China. Emperor Taizong ordered the Gospels and other scriptures to be copied and placed in the capital library, and announced that this new luminous religion, called Jingzhao, would be tolerated and its adherents allowed to practice within the Tang dynasty's borders. As the nation began to rebuild from the numerous rebellions and uprisings of the late 700s, a new political order emerged in which the regional military governors held a significant amount of power, verging on outright political autonomy. In 805, Emperor Xianzong took the throne and proceeded to embark on a series of campaigns that brought these outlying regions back under direct control of the imperial court. His reign would later be seen as a restoration of the Tang Empire. In the early 800s, the Chinese made an important discovery which would eventually change the course of human history. While experimenting with various elements and chemicals, probably in an attempt to create the elusive elixir of life sought after by Taoists, alchemists stumbled upon gunpowder. The texts they left behind give accounts of some people getting killed while mixing elements, including sulfur and saltpeter, or becoming severely maimed or burned when igniting the mixture. The original Chinese name for this substance is Huoyao, which means fire medicine. Owing to the danger in such a chemical combination, it would be another 200 years before it would be utilized as a weapon, but it's worth noting that alchemists in China discovered it 400 years before the first such discovery would occur in Europe. Things seemed to be looking up for the Tang toward the end of Emperor Xianzong's reign, but soon after he died in 820, many of the regions which he had brought back under imperial control would rebel once more, and it would be some time before they would be brought to heel. Meanwhile, the power of chancellors as well as court eunuchs continued to increase, and in addition to the external problems facing the empire, political factionalism began to take hold and persist across the reigns of many emperors in a continuous internal struggle. When the Japanese envoys arrived for their diplomatic mission in 838, they were greeted by Emperor Wenzong, who offered a letter to Emperor Nimyo, which the diplomats happily delivered when they returned in 839. Among the passengers who had been selected to make this once-in-a-lifetime journey was a Tendai Buddhist monk named Ennin. Born in 794, the year the Japanese court moved to Heian-kyo, Ennin hailed from a regional clan in the Kanto. He had studied under Saicho, joining the community on Mount Hiei, which became the Enryaku-ji temple complex. Following in his mentor's footsteps by traveling to China and studying at the temple on Tiantai Mountain seems to have been an irresistible dream. Nearly everything about his journey, however, would go completely awry. He had been on one of the ships that tried to embark in 836, which had turned back because of dangerous storms. When the sea was passable enough to cross in 838, they still had to charter ships from Silla rather than cross the rough waters themselves. Then when he managed to arrive in China, he was unable to obtain permission to study at Tiantai Mountain. He left his official group and attempted to stay in China illegally, but was caught when villagers in the town where he was staying grew suspicious of his claim that he was a monk from Silla when he didn't seem to speak Korean. Ironically, an actual monk from Silla befriended him in Yangzhou, where he and his fellow Japanese monks were staying, and advised him to travel to Mount Wutai. He slipped past the authorities once more and went north, traveling over 1,100 kilometers, almost 700 miles, to the faraway temple on the mountain. Now at last he was where he wanted to be. He copied sutras, discussed the latest subjects of debate between the schools, and learned what he could. Things were finally going well in 840 when he traveled to Chang'an at the invitation of the abbot of Daxing Temple. There he learned many esoteric rituals and sutras. He began writing to the Tang court asking for safe passage home to Japan during this time, but his request was denied. Every following request he sent would likewise be denied, and according to his diary, he made this request over 100 times. In 840, Emperor Wenzong died, and a new sovereign was elevated to the throne. Emperor Wuzong was devoted to Taoism to the extent that calling him a fanatic would not be out of line. While both religions had been allowed to grow and flourish in China thus far, there was a fundamental conflict between Taoism and Buddhism, which, in spite of any exterior similarities, sometimes erupted in violence. You may recall that one of Empress Wu Zetian's lovers was a fanatical Buddhist monk who frequently subjected Taoist clergy to physical assaults. Doctrinally speaking, the conflict between the two arose from their stated goals. The goal of Buddhism was extinguishment of desire, while the objective of Taoism was achieving immortality. To Emperor Wuzong and like-minded Taoist Chinese nobles, Buddhism seemed like a cult that worshipped death. In 842, the government, backed largely by reform-minded Confucian scholars, declared that Buddhism had become corrupt and needed to be purified. In particular, the edict targeted so-called undesirables who were operating within the Buddhist religious establishment. These were former practitioners of black magic, as well as convicted criminals. I feel compelled to note that these were likely repentant people who had sought Buddhist ordination because they regretted their past actions. The edict also declared that any Buddhist monk or nun who owned property must either surrender it to the government or forfeit their status as clergy. This persecution had a practical aim in addition to its religious dimension. Buddhist temples and monasteries did not pay tax on the land they owned, and Emperor Wuzong needed funds in part to repel an invasion of northern China by a remnant group of the Uyghur Khanate. In 843, the Uyghurs were defeated decisively, but this campaign proved costly both in soldiers' lives and their salaries. In 844, after a few years of Taoist lobbying, talk of reform was thrown out the window as Emperor Wuzong attempted to expel every foreign religion from China's borders. Monasteries and temples were seized, monks and nuns expelled and forced to regrow their hair and find a new means of survival. Statues and other items of worship were broken, melted down for their material, and otherwise destroyed. Because Buddhism was the largest of the so-called foreign religions, its losses were the greatest. But it was by no means the only target of Emperor Wuzong's zeal. Zoroastrianism and Manichaeism, two Persian religions which had gained practitioners in some communities, are generally believed to have permanently disappeared from China at this point. Jingzhao, Chinese Christianity, was also delegitimized, its churches seized and its practitioners scattered. This was not the absolute end of Christianity in China, but it would be hundreds of years before it gained a significant enough following to be noteworthy once more. Interestingly enough, both Zoroastrianism and Christianity were believed by the imperial court to be splinter groups of Buddhism, which is part of why they were targeted, in addition to being considered foreign corrupting influences. Islam was practiced in some western parts of China, and it seems to have escaped the court's attention. The reason for this is probably that the practitioners were mostly Arab traders, and Islam had not yet found enough ready converts among the native Chinese population to be noticed by the government. Ennin was directly targeted by all of this, but especially by an edict in 845 that all foreign monks would be stripped of their religious status and expelled from the country. This did not mean a return ticket, however, and Ennin still had to make his own way through Silla to return to Japan, which he eventually did in 847, buying passage from a merchant of Silla to Hakata Bay and re-entering the country through the Dazaifu Fortress. In 854, he became the abbot of the Tendai School and expanded the temple complex of Enryaku-ji. Some of the sutras he brought back contained teachings of Pure Land beliefs and practices, which would eventually transform the religious landscape of the nation in later periods. In spite of his hardships, Ennin was somewhat fortunate. He was able to see his homeland again. Many other foreign priests were not so lucky. In 846, Emperor Wuzong died. It's commonly believed that all of the elixirs of life which he was sampling from his Taoist advisors finally poisoned him, though it's also a possibility that he was poisoned intentionally. In any case, he was dead, and Emperor Xuanzong took the throne and declared amnesty for the targets of the religious persecution and an end to seizing property and defrocking. The second half of the 800s started out well enough with Emperor Xuanzong at the helm, and his meritocratic management of the state bureaucracy ensured that the machinery of government worked as smoothly as it could. The late 800s, however, were less kind. Once more, the regional military governors started accruing independent, autonomous power, and this time there would be no Emperor Xianzong to restore the fractious empire. Child emperors thrust upon the throne by ambitious chancellors and eunuchs ensured a weakening of the central government, and the military governors became petty warlords, claiming the mandate of heaven for themselves as they founded new dynasties which struggled for control over their neighbors. The last Tang emperor, at age 15, abdicated the throne in 907, naming military governor Zhu Wen his successor. The next year, Zhu Wen arranged for the boy to be poisoned. The Tang dynasty was gone at last, and an age remembered as the Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms period had begun. Next time, we'll turn our attention to the Korean Peninsula, where Silla and Balhae would also both have a very tumultuous time in the 800s. Until then, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at A History of Japan. Visit the online store, ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com, and find us on the web, ahistoryofjapan.com.